Hello, and welcome to ESPK Studios. It's been months, and I still don't have a new intro. And I do apologize a bit for that. It's busy here. My normal life has kind of been taken over by helping build mountain bike trails. All that really does is take up like one of my days off. Anyway, got some motivation tonight. And it is the 22nd of November, 2013, and I am your host, Richard Dort, and this is ESPK Studios. And tonight, you're going to hear the first part. It's going to be two or three parts long, I think. Of an interview with Jeff Moore, who is one of the first Impulse owners in the San Francisco area. He is a funny guy, and he is new to motorcycling, but owned a few bikes and has some really great analogies between the Impulse that he owns and the bikes that he owned previously, and just some really cool insight, and is not afraid to talk about the bike or go into detail. So this is going to be a several part thing. I'm not going to ever do a 15-minute podcast. That is not how I do things. You can't get... It's pointless. To me, it's pointless in this genre because you just can't get any kind of detail. If you want 15 minutes of entertainment, go watch the Hollywood Stars or something. In this podcast, let's see, what do we cover? Let me get my notes here. We cover a lot. We cover Aerostitch and men with beards, key fob testing, early adoptership, inexpensive parts, commuting, and the transmission on the Impulse. Again, it's all fairly detailed. I do try what I was trying to do was cover the first day, what the process he went through to selecting the Impulse and actually buying it, and while just trying to get that first day in, we cover a whole lot of stuff. In typical ESBK fashion, we meander a bit, but I do enjoy it, and I'm going to break this up over the next few weeks, and it's a little bit less work for me. And hopefully some more consistent podcasts for you. News is, you missed the introductory period. If you were, I am charging for this site now. Individual podcasts are only 50 cents. And I think you have access to the post that they are in for a week and unlimited downloading and playing. If you want to listen to all the podcasts for a full year, it's $10. It was $7.50, but that introductory period is gone now. It was actually extended for a week by accident because I was home in Maine helping a family member move down to Tennessee. And instead of being gone for a week, I was gone for 2 weeks. Also, reading... written content will cost you $7.50 a year, but you get to read. I had done it three free articles a week, and I've now changed it to a month. The realities are I have lots of costs coming up to the website. I could go back to the old way of doing things when I originally started, which is just a free WordPress blog site. But that would eliminate the podcasts. I have too many podcasts. It doesn't matter kind of how I do it. If I keep the podcast, which is original intent of this website, I still have to pay money. I cannot afford the website on my own anymore. Like, things have gotten that tight now. So I implore you, please buy a membership. I've got a few months before things start coming due. Not many, though. I think it's this spring. And various things come due at various different times. And if I do not get enough money to keep Skype subscriptions up and the website the various fees for the websites and domains and stuff like that. If I do not have the money to do it, I will simply let it die. I got, it's yeah, just the realities of my situation right now and of this. Yeah, it's a confusing thing to do this. Really want to do more, really want to cover races and be at races, but no one is willing to give me any money. And I feel like I've proven what I can do when I've been given money. So I guess I haven't. I guess is the answer to that. Either way, but that's just no harm, no foul. It's if people buy subscriptions and I get enough money to keep the site running, then I'll keep the site running. If I don't, then I will. The market has spoken. There's just not the demand for the knowledge. Now, the past few weeks, I've been gone, and there hasn't been much content for, like, I don't know, last month and a half, 2 months. So that is my own fault for not giving you guys a reason to come to the site. Other than that, I finally got the look of the darn website fixed. It was a little bit of a weird bug in one of the blog posts, was throwing everything off as far as the look of the front page. So it wasn't an issue before, but when I got some new updates that came in, it became an issue, and occasionally the website would look right for a second and then not. So I don't know what that was all about. Yeah. So that's a quick part of the news in the front end. This podcast, if you're listening to it, then you've paid your 50 cents or you've paid a yearly subscription. And for that, I really thank you. I thank you very much. Please encourage all your friends. If I've received some encouraging messages when I was like, I'm not sure I want to, where I'm going to go with this, letters of encouragement really meant a lot, and they do go so far, but I have no financial room at all to do this without help. And I could not make advertising work on this site, and I don't have anyone who can fix that for me, much less do it for free. And I don't have anyone that can make my website look better for free. So I have to pay to get these things fixed. I have to pay someone who knows what they're doing. And I do not have the money for that. So that's where your fees will be going. But other than the gloom and doom, just a heads up, really. Man, Jeff's a fun guy. So we talk a lot about this is all about the Impulse. He owns an Impulse R, the Brammo sport bike with the transmission, and we just talk about ownership and what the initial ownership was like. And he's done a lot of things, and the next two parts you're really going to want to listen to as well. So without further ado, here's Jeff. Hello, ESBK Studio listeners. This was supposed to be a roundtable discussion of Impulse owners, but they all are sad, sad people. The only cool one on the entire forum, except maybe Brammo Fan and occasionally Gavin, is the gentleman I have are right here, right now, who showed up and got a hold of me, and that is Jeff Moore. How are you doing tonight, Jeff?
I'm doing very well.
All right. We're gonna move on tonight, and because some of you probably have read my Facebook post and have actually, as recording this, already liked it, how I was getting excited for the roundtable. But that's all right. Jeff has probably got more miles than anyone on an Impulse, except maybe the test rider at Brammo. So this should actually be a really solid interview. How are you doing tonight, Jeff?
I'm doing excellently. I just crossed the 10,000 mile barrier today and celebrated by taking a bunch of hilarious glamour shots.
Nice. When will we when and where will we find those?
Oh, they will be plastered all over the forum shamelessly. It's
Excellent.
yeah, have no fear.
Okay. Feel free to email me a bunch of them, and I'll sure I'll either put them up on Facebook or if I decide I can make a blog post out of them. That'll be a lot of fun.
Sweet. Yeah, I mean I gotta show off the custom tail tidy and turn signals somehow, you know.
Yeah. They take long for people to start modding that thing. All right. So what quickly kind of what's your background? What do you do? How long have you been riding motorcycles?
So I am a software engineer, in the San Francisco Bay Area. I live in Oakland, work in San Francisco. I have been riding motorcycles for about 2 years now. And actually pretty soon here, I'm going to have ridden an electric motorcycle longer than I've ridden gas motorcycles, which I don't know how common that is. I found out about the Impulse through, I have a old friend of mine who actually lives in Ashland, and he, of course, has a rock climbing buddy who works at Brammo, because everybody in Ashland is outdoorsy as hell, and, you know, they all rock climb. So I actually ended up, you know, kind of touring the factory, meeting the crew. They were all super cool, and got myself on the list, and got my bike in January or so, and I have since stopped riding all my other motorcycles.
There you go. Now, you are, and we're going to go into the story a little bit, or I'm going to drag you through the whole Impulse story, but and we'll try to get a kind of a timeline of how things happened for you. But you're one of those folks who, and there's several of you on the forum and out and about, who bought a gas motorcycle first to learn how to ride so that when the Impulse showed up, you knew how to ride. Is that correct?
That is not my case, actually. I bought a gas motorcycle because I moved to Oakland, and the BART parking lot near where my new place of living was is tiny and fills up at 7 a.m. So I thought, hey, I'll buy a cheap motorcycle. I can. There's always parking at BART, whatever, and, you know, then my life proceeded to spiral into motorcycle madness from there.
Okay. My apologies.
Yeah, but no, I mean, effectively, I bought a cheap, you know, $900 82 Suzuki, and then went from that to a, you know, $3,000 Multistrada to a $19,000 electric bike. So I don't know what the hell the next motorcycle I'm going to buy, but I'm really scared.
Mission Motors?
Right.
Nice. All right. Okay, so I jumped to a conclusion, and I apologize for that. Wow, that is a different twist, because usually it's, I think most of the riders, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you probably participate a little bit more on the Brammo forums, most of those riders on there are either, like, the folks that just got in an electric motorcycle because they wanted an electric motorcycle.
Yeah.
And so they're new to motorcycling that way, or they're folks that have been riding for a really long time.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
All right, so you're the outlier.
Excellent.
Nice.
I screw up everybody's charts.
Yeah. I know the feeling. You're in good company. All right, cool. Really cool. All right, so I'm going to kind of revisit the drama a bit, and I'm not sure how familiar you are. When did you – they unveiled the Impulse in – what was it, 2011? Yes, it was it was the 2011 Laguna Seca race is when they unveiled the prototype.
And that was the one with the clip-ons and the single-seat cowl and all that.
Yeah, and it didn't have a transmission or none of that. Were you aware of that bike?
I was not even aware of any motorcycles at that point because, you know, motorcycles, who would ride those?
So that's before your time.
Yeah, yeah.
Had they decided to put a transmission on it by the time you became aware?
Yes. In fact, that's so. The thing that made me aware of the Impulse was the video that Eric Bostrom and Wes Seiler did with them sort of tearing around some back roads near the Brammo headquarters.
Yes, yes.
And by that point, it was pretty much, you know, not quite the full production bike, but it was very, very close and had the transmission.
Right. Oh, yeah, it was just minor wiggles here and there after that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you missed the whole two-year wait drama.
Oh, yeah. I only got the good part.
So you're not one of the angry people I want to talk to?
I mean, yes, I'm fed up, and I won't stand it.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, there's some folks who did. They got fed up waiting. and they went and bought a Zero. And there's some who, I guess, just got fed up and then went and, I don't know if they bought an Impulse Sense or not. I don't know. All right. So, yeah, the Wes Seiler video, that was this year. So you only recently became, year?
That was September 2012, maybe August 2012.
Yes. Okay. And then, go ahead.
Yeah. I watched that video, and I can tell you the precise moment that all was lost to me was when there's about, you know, the video starts, and there's kind of this inception, like, wow noise, and then shortly thereafter, it's, you know, the two of them tearing up one of their local roads, and it makes the noise. It made that Impulse sort of TIE fighter noise. And that just did terrible things to, like, these nether, like, Neanderthal regions of my brain, where all my latent childhood sort of, like, desires to have a TIE fighter, you know, God knows what, I had to have it.
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, and then, you know, I Scuderia got a demo bike. I heard they got a demo bike, and I went and rode the demo bike, and sure enough, it made the noise. And you know, it was just all downhill from there.
Nice. Cool. All right, so that was September of last year. That was after the big launch party in May. All right, so you missed all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you, looking back, being one of those folks that got to miss out on all the angst and the wait,
right.
How does that look to you? Do you kind of look back and go, you know, really? Or do you kind of understand? Or,
well, I mean, I like to think I understand. I mean, I work in software. I have been part of a product team. I have been presented with technical challenges or, you know, changes of scope, or, you know, I have been presented with things that have forced me and or my team to, you know, reevaluate and delay a feature because we want it to be the best product we can make, and we don't want to release, you know, something we don't want to call the best.
Right.
And so from that standpoint, I understand.
Right.
That doesn't make me totally able to empathize with, you know, like, if I put myself in the shoes of, you know, let's say I had found out about the thing in 2011 and was just, like, yearning in my loins for this thing, and it was delayed by 2 years, yeah, I'm sure I'd be suffering for some, you know, terrible, terrible things, but, yeah.
All right, cool. So, when did you put in the pre-order?
Call it November. I visited the factory when I went up to visit my buddy for Thanksgiving, and I had put in the pre-order before that.
Okay.
And so, yeah, sometime November, I want to say.
All right. And so, I mean, so you found out about it in August. Did it seem like, because we got the release party in May, and then we're like, Brian, no, I take that back, because I went back and tried to listen. Somewhere they said, we assure you we'll have the bike ready before the end of riding season. And, of course, that never happened. Did you hear that, or did you kind of know, this is going to be a while, and I won't have it till January? And
I was actually supposed to get mine in March or something, and some people in front of me backed out. And so my schedule of acquiring the bike was actually significantly faster than I thought it'd be. So there you go. I'm just ruining everything.
No, you're fine. You're not ruining anything. No, absolutely.
But yeah, no, I mean, I was figuring March, and to tell the truth, you know, especially having worked at a small company, having, you know, like I said, seen, call it, you know, logistical problems, I was expecting later. Like, I was not expecting anything to happen on schedule at all. And I was, you know, sort of flabbergasted when Don, that was when, you know, Don still had Scuderia, and he called me and said, hey, like, we have a bike, you can have it, come on down, and I proceeded to freak out.
Nice. It's mine, it's here, yeah, it's Christmas, ah!
Yep.
All right, so, let's see here. So you got it, like, man, it was like a couple of weeks after Christmas then, huh?
Yeah, I got it, probably toward the end of January.
Okay, well, about a month after Christmas. And then, all right, so what was it like to go pick that up? What was that experience like?
You can live this vicariously by looking up the Scuderia Facebook page and seeing me with just the shit-eatingest grin you've ever seen in your life. Just, I mean, I look at that picture of me and I hate me. Like, like, yeah, just ridiculous.
And you got the R then.
Mm-hmm. The process of selecting the R was a two-part process. I asked my buddy who sort of got me into riding. I asked his opinion about it, and he said, he's like, dude, if you're gonna buy a $17,000 electric motorcycle, you might as well buy a $19,000 electric motorcycle. And then the other sort of consensus was, well, if you buy the cheap one without all the fancy adjustable bits, you're just going to want to put all that stuff on there anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also, where the hell are you going to find aftermarket parts for a Brammo? So that was sort of the decision. And then also, even if I hadn't made that decision, the R was the one they made first. So
right.
That sort of made the decision for me. So.
All right. Yeah, because it was months later before the E1s finally started getting delivered, right?
Yeah. And honestly, I'm very happy with the decision to get the R, if for nothing else, the suspension, the adjustable suspension.
All right. Well, the E1 isn't non-adjustable, it's just semi-adjustable.
Yeah, it's less fancy.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Less fancy, yeah. For some reason, I kept thinking it had Olean's. Someone's like, where are you getting that? And I'm like, oh, wait a second.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So, all right, cool. And then, so you went and picked it up at Scuderia. You get like a charge card with it?
Yes. Now, so ChargePoint. I guess Brammo did some deal with ChargePoint. You get a little like Brammo branded ChargePoint key fob, and I don't think ChargePoint, when they designed their key fobs, ever intended them to be used with motorcycles, because the first thing I did was put it on my keychain, ride in the rain a whole bunch, and the key fob was ruined. So, you know, but I have gotten several since then. But yeah, I got a ChargePoint account and a little thing, and yeah, that was nice.
What have you done to eliminate the key fob issues?
So I am one of those lovely breeds of motorcyclists who wear an Aero Stitch.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm all about responsibility. I actually have a prosthetic beard that comes with it.
Oh, yeah, don't make me laugh like that.
Right. So Aero Stitch sells an accessory that goes on your arm, left forearm, that's a clear thing. I think it's designed to put a map in. I used it to hold my work garage door RFID card and my charge point replacement key fob. And so whenever I want to charge a charge point, I just hold my arm up to the thing. And,
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm like, cheek.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I used to be a, I say used to be because of poor bikes and pieces back home in Maine, has been for years, a VFR rider.
Ah.
Yes. Now my VFR, and I don't know if you clearly haven't heard some of the previous podcasts, so I'm going to go into this a little bit and hopefully not bore people who have heard it already. My VFR had some serious personality conflicting issues. It did not know what it wanted to be because I had the automatic chain oiling system on it. The Scott Oiler.
Uh-huh.
I had saddlebags for it and a tank bag, matching tank bag. I had, what else did I have that was more touring setup? I had a GPS mount for it. And I think I got kind of more of a touring seat for it. It's got a, I can't remember what the brand is right now. Sergeant. I think I got a Sergeant.
Yep.
Used, but got a good deal. So there was touring stuff about the bike, especially I use it as a commuter bike, like a, you know, like you use your Impulse. So it got used a lot, but it had I did have a full exhaust put on it, and I did have it tuned, so it had a jet kit and air filter. It came with that, and that got me power everywhere. It didn't just take away, it didn't just give me top end power. I got power everywhere, so it was still very usable. It was very nice when the bike was loaded down, you know, and it was easier to drive in parking lots and stuff. But, oh, man. You cracked that bad boy open. I couldn't. I tried one day to wring it out in fifth, and I just chickened out. I got to 10 grand in fifth gear and went, you know what? I just, no. And then what else? But then you get in the suspension, and I had a Penske rear shock, and I had taking the internals out of a CBR F2 and re-shimmed the stacks, the dampening stacks, and got some special parts from a guy and that I can't talk about. It was years ago, so it really doesn't matter now, but even still. And then, so I tuned. Yeah, so I had three times as much in my suspension as I did in the you know, any motor performance stuff. And I had lower clip-ons. But I am I am 6'2", but I did put lower clip-ons on, and then I can't remember what else. So I had a Barnett clutch. Upgraded master cylinders for the brakes and full stainless steel lines all the way around. And that was upgraded master cylinders, a hydraulic clutch, so the front brake and clutch master cylinders matched. Everything was, so it really didn't know if it was a track bike or a touring bike. It really just didn't know.
Did you take it to the track?
I never did. I just didn't have the money. I had full leathers, Honda. I still got them. Full Honda racing leathers.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And
perfect.
Oh, God. Yeah, don't tell me about it. Yeah. It's actually, it was the leathers that were designed to work with, that looked good with the RC51 at the time, but the color scheme still worked okay. Never had the money to go to the track. And the track back, I lived in Maine. When I got out of I was in the Navy, and then I got out of the Navy, and I was home in Maine, and it was 6 hours. I don't know, it was hours and hours to get to any racetrack from where I lived in Maine.
Right.
And my choice was Southern New Hampshire or Southern Quebec.
Yep.
So I didn't know which way to go, and I didn't really have anyone that had a pickup truck that wanted to drive me 6 hours to either of those places.
I recommend moving to California.
I would move to California if I could know that I could get a job that paid enough, you know, because I've heard what it takes to live in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
So, but, I used to be a Navy airplane electrician, but people like, you know, how long ago was that? I'm like 10 years. And I'm like, yeah. So, but you hear of anything, you let me know. But otherwise than that, no. So, no, I understand the whole, I understand the Viffer thing. We were an even weirder bunch, but you get into that, we were in that realm of the whole sport touring crowd.
Yep.
And so I know very well what Aerostitch is.
I actually, Aerostitch showed up, they had a pop-up sale in San Francisco.
Cool.
And it apparently was the first one they did, and of course I had to show up on the Impulse.
Nice.
And I confused a lot of people there that day. I went there with a couple friends of mine, and, you know, we probably lowered the median age in there by 20 years as soon as we walked in.
Yep.
But, you know, Aerostitch has such a following in the Bay Area, you know, particular because, I mean, if you have an Aerostitch, you can ride a motorcycle year-round in the Bay Area. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it rains occasionally, but, you know, really the rideable season never ends as long as you're not afraid of a little rain now and again. And so there's a huge following in the Bay Area, and I'm sure they knew to some extent because of sales or whatever, but I'm not sure they were prepared for the kind of level of, like, young hooligans here that, you know, that enjoy Aerostitches but also enjoy doing, you know, wheelies and burnouts. And so, like, there's a picture somewhere of my housemate when we had to change the tire when I finally went through the Avons. We clearly had to send the rear one out on a Viking funeral, and so there's a picture of my housemate in an Aerostitch. Just, I mean, it looks like a Spinal Tap show. It's just insane. And I keep telling him he needs to send that picture to Aerostitch, because, you know, Aerostitch, electric motorcycle, burnout, it is confusing in every kind of intersection of Venn diagram there is to be confused on a motorcycle.
I'm sorry. probably Richard 230, if he listens to this, is hating me right now, you know? So, that's awesome. I kind of been that guy, you know, I got a VFR when I was early 20s, you know, and most guys on VFRs are the 30s and onward, because they used to ride, RRR Grand, you know, hardcore edge sport bike, and are just like, I just don't need that anymore.
Right.
You know, but usually you kind of got to be aware of the old guy in the VFR, because he used to ride 900RR.
Right.
And he can, you know, he can throw that VFR around, so, you know. Yeah, but, all right, cool. Well, at least you know what a VFR is. Most people are like, what? What's that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a mighty
steed.
It is. Flat torquer, which, you know, kind of leads me into the electric thing. But, all right, so we've picked on Aerostitch people for long enough.
Excellent.
But, okay, so I don't even remember where we were. You'd picked it up, you got the key fob. Oh, that's how we got the Aerostitch, because of the key fob solution.
Yeah.
All right, so you picked it up. And it was the end of January. You have Aerostitch, so you can ride year round, so you're good to go. What did you do when you, did you ride it from the dealership to home?
Yeah, it was raining on brand new tires on an electric motorcycle. And Don was just like, don't ever use first gear for like a week.
Nice.
Yeah, and then I didn't. I spun up that rear tire more times than I care to admit. Kind of that first. I mean, even in second, it was hilarious. And you know, especially in San Francisco proper, you know, you have all these metal construction sort of grates and plates and just terrible, terrible road surface with all these, like, you know, muni tracks. In fact, I dropped the bike, you know, couple months in on wet muni tracks, and instant wheel spin. Yeah,
let me ask you, since you mentioned that, I've been wondering about, and I know on the bigger bikes I've talked to some racers, and it really depends on the bike, to be honest with you, but how is the throttle control, say, you know, spinning an electric bike up versus spinning a gas bike up? Is there a little more ease of control on the electric bike?
I mean, in terms of, I mean, spinning up the rear tire?
Yeah, I mean, once it's spinning, is it easier to get, is it a little more natural and easier to get it back under control?
I mean, I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that question, just because, I haven't been riding that long. But
okay,
the incidents I've had where I have spun up the rear tire, and I'll also keep in mind, my previous motorcycles I've ridden have not been that powerful, so I never really had this issue before. But the times on the Impulse that I've accidentally spun up the rear tire, and there have been many, you know, manhole covers, wet paint lines, I mean, just tons and tons of spinning up the rear tire, I have never crashed because of that.
Okay.
The one time I crashed was me foolishly trying to change lanes across or parallel to muni tracks, and that was just a terrible idea.
All right. Okay. So, all right. So that kind of answers my question a bit. I mean, you know, it's been natural enough that it hasn't gone hog wild. And
yeah, I mean, and it's, I mean, the thing about the bike in terms of throttle response or throttle predictability, I mean, it is, and you know, this is probably true of any electric, just when you have the same exact response every single time, you know, there's no valves to go out of stuff. There's no, I mean, there's no variation or decay in how the throttle acts over time at all. And it's just, it's immaculately predictable every single time. And so that, I don't know, that sold me on the impulse, but I'm sure that's a trait of all electrics.
Hmm. All right. Excellent. Excellent. And that's a really good point that I forget about, is that it is the exact same response every single time as compared to a gas bike, because there's just so many parts and variables involved in that.
Oh, yeah.
As good as they are.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I remember some interview where Brian said something to this effect, but I have found it to be true in practice. You do not have to be a good motorcyclist to ride the impulse quickly. You know, to especially off the line, you know, to launch, you know, a Panigale or something, you know, you have to contend with flywheels and feathering the clutch and all this, you know, all this stuff. And to launch the impulse, I mean, it's like playing a video game. Just, you know, press go.
I hadn't heard that analogy before, but yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense. All right, cool. And then, all right, so you got a home safe.
I did.
You got a home safe, and you pulled out the Clipper Creek charger that came with it and plugged it in the wall?
Yep. And, in fact, I kept using that Clipper Creek charger until, I want to say, about a month ago when I bought the Level 2 Clipper Creek charger.
Ah.
Actually, this is going to seem the infinite spiral of motorcycles. I bought that charger because of the track.
Oh, okay.
Because when I the first track day I went to, when I went to that that refuel event,
yeah,
the Brammo folks generously let me use their. They had a couple Clipper Creek Level 2 chargers that they had sort of grafted on a NEMA 1450 on the end of it, and you know, used them to plug into the RV outlets at the track, and so they let me use theirs. At I think I went to 3 track days where they were there, I was gonna go to one by myself, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't gonna have free Brammo charging to mooch off of, so I bought my own, and it's been great.
And what is it? What does it plug into? Can you kind of describe?
Well, by default, it is just bare wire. It is the Clipper Creek LCS 25. It's designed to be put on a wall in your house and plugged into the electricity of your house. But if you go to Home Depot and spend, you know, $10 or something, you can get any connector you want. I put on the NEMA 1450, which is the one that you plug. It looks very similar to the thing you plug your dryer into. And RVs plug into the 50-amp outlets at campgrounds and at the track. And that happens to be a very nice source of Level 2 power.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's been totally solid.
All right, so the end that you bought is the 50-amp, same 50-amp end they use at RV camps?
Yep.
Okay. All right. But you're probably only getting, like, what? Okay, 24 amps at home.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, anywhere, because that's the max the impulse will pull.
Right, okay. Okay, that's cool. Sweet. So, man, we do have a lot to talk about with you as the story unfolds. All right, so you got her home, you got her plugged in, you're using that. Now, so you're using the normal 110 at first.
Yes.
Did that affect how you use the bike at all?
At first, no, because my procedure, because my commute is about 15 to 16 miles each way, and even with some of that being freeway, I only use about 20% on the way into the city and 25% on the way back, because traffic's usually faster at the end of the day. And so even with that, I still have plenty of time. I still have plenty of charge to get home, and so I would just get home and plug it in overnight and you know, go to sleep or whatever. The only time it really affected me was on weekends when, you know, I would go out for a ride, get home, and then my friends would come over and want to go out for another ride, and I'd be like, oh, hang on, I have to plug in my appliance.
Sorry. That's like the one time you're like, oh, hell.
Right. Yeah,
you know, oh, this thing is great. It's wonderful. I'm going to go for another ride. Oh, son
yep.
of a...
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so now you're charging faster at home because you've got the level 2. So you're pulling a full 24 amps out.
Yep.
And does that help with that?
Yes. In fact, that's what I did today. went out and took some... you know, lurid glamour shots of the bike, of the new Tail Tidy and stuff like that. Got home, housemate's coworker came over on his CBR and wanted to go out for a group ride, and we did that. I think I did like 120 miles today. So, yeah.
All right, so that's no longer an issue. All right, cool. So it wasn't an issue except on the weekends, which makes sense and kind of what I thought, but it's always nice to hear that that's what it is in reality. And so you're commuting, did you notice that now I'm going to stumble three more times. What was the weather like in San Francisco when you bought that? And did that have you noticed the effect that has on range?
No. In fact, the only effect on range I've noticed from weather is, when it is just super hot out. You can only charge so fast because the batteries have a thermal cutback.
Oh, okay. How cold does it get in San Francisco in the winter? I'm from Maine, so...
Ah, no, not nearly cold enough.
No, no. I'm in Tennessee now, and I'm like, yeah, it's winter, but... Yeah,
yeah no. I mean, when it's cold out, and I'm air-quoting cold like mad, when it gets cold out in San Francisco, I will start the bike up. It'll have a message saying, you know, cold battery, something or other, and that message will be there for, call it, 5 minutes until the battery warmers heat the batteries up to an adequate temperature, and then it's gone. And so I don't even, like, if it's really cold out, it'll turn the regen off, but that's about it.
Okay. All right. So, that didn't affect range, because I know some people, I think, have had range issues when it was really cold. And
yeah, I'm sure, but...
Because the airflow was...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, I can't remember his name right now, or his blog's name, but he had kind of made some blankets for his batteries.
Ah, yes, the horse blanket. Oh, that was fantastic.
Yeah. they were so efficient at cooling themselves through air, they were too efficient in the, right. like, 50 to 40 degree weather he was in, or whatever it was.
Yeah, and the only thing I experienced was, and you know, the early days of ownership were just hilarious because I would send an email to, you know, the folks at Brammo about, you know, some situation I encountered, and I could hear them just sort of groaning over there about, like, I live at the top of a huge hill, and in the mornings I am effectively coasting downhill for about, you know, call it 2 miles. And the first version of the firmware, it would like throw some error code. Didn't do anything, but it would throw some error code going like, oh my god, what are you doing? Because it'd try to regen above 100% and, you know, it's no idea what's going on. And so you know, months and months later, I'm at a track day and a bunch of the Brammo folks are there, and I happen to mention, like, oh yeah, because I'm on top of this huge hill, and one of the engineers perks up, he's like, you're the guy on the top of the huge hill.
At that point, you want to run for the hills, yeah. Nice. You're the guy on top of the huge hill. Throwing all my programming off.
Yep.
All right, so... all right, so that was... Now, there's a... What's the warm-up procedure like on the Impulse? Because don't you leave that plugged in overnight, right?
I do, because when it's plugged in, it actually leaves the battery, like, heaters/coolers on, and it kind of self-regulates the temperature. So, in fact, when that, you know, I when I kind of emailed back and forth with Brian or whoever about the battery cutoff or battery sort of cold message, they were just like, yeah, leave it plugged in and it'll be fine. So I usually just, if you leave it plugged in overnight, it self-regulates.
Yeah, and so it's ready to go when you get up in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, now, like, this time of year, I mean, in the terrible, you know, brutal San Francisco October, it's, you know, 60 degrees out. And so the only time I really worry about it is sort of December and January. And even then it's, you know, oh, it's 50 degrees.
Okay. All right. Okay, cool. Because that's kind of helpful information. And you had said that even if it's cold and it's not plugged in, you turn it on, you just kind of wait 5 minutes and the battery warmers will.
Yeah. Like before I knew to leave it plugged in, I would just turn it on when I, you know, kind of was getting ready and leave it sitting on for a few minutes and it'd be fine.
Okay. Yeah, the battery warmers kick on. Well, that's a cool feature. I mean, that's time, like, you wake up, you know, you go out to your bike, you go out, you just turn it on because it's not like a gas bike where you're just going to be sitting there idling forever and you got to, watch the choke. You know, like, I have a manual. I've carbureted, so.
Yeah.
You know, I've always had carbureted bikes, so I've always had to, like, and the Hondas will, like, run for a while, and all of a sudden they go, and you go,
yep.
Cycle it back a little bit, and then 5 minutes later, and so yeah, you just turn it on, and then you go and put your gear on, and get your backpack and fart around for a while,
yep.
And then it's good to go when you leave. Well, that's,
yep.
That's easy. That's not hard. Does it cool? You said is it kind of keep it plugged in the summertime so it cools itself?
Yeah. So the batteries themselves are air-cooled. There's a fan.
Right.
So the fan will kick on, and it'll, you know, shove air at it, and that is effective unless it's, you know, crazy hot out. You know, if the air coming in is hotter than, you know. So the one time I've ever run into a problem was I was just in this is like Sacramento area. Actually, I was riding the bike up to Thunderhill for a track day, just to see if I could. And yeah, I stopped in like Davis or somewhere and it was 100+ and I was only able to pull like 15 amps out of the level 2 charger because it was just cutting back on the,
thermals. Yeah.
Hmm.
All right. Yeah. That's a bit of a topic. Protomech Michael Beatty will talk about that from time to time. You'll see him when he mentions fast charging, he'll mention cooling, you know? Yeah, it's one of the issues with that.
I mean, and you also run into it on the track, just because, I mean, if you're really on it, the batteries will they'll get mad at you after, you know, a few laps. And I mean, they still work fine. It just turns off the regen because it doesn't want you charging them when they're that hot.
Oh, okay. I haven't talked to, I don't think Shalina's had that issue. I don't think we've talked about heat management issues and the power dialing back, but I don't think she's ever talked about the regen being shut off.
Hmm, yeah.
All right, cool. But she's riding the TTX and then they've got all kinds of, they're like, we know it can take the heat, but we programmed it to not, so it would be reliable but it's not like software, it's like firmware or hardwired or something, you know, and they're just, they're just going, Shalina told me, conversation I had the other night, she's like, you know, talking about the Zero guys, like, they're dialing it to 11, why can't we dial it to 11?
You know? They're on the track, like, dumping ice on the bikes, like.
Yeah, that was Ted Rich at Laguna. Yeah. Hilarious. Yeah, that's, you know, and I'm like, well, it's not the same, Shalina. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah, no, when Shalina graciously sort of took me around the track and gave me pointers, and by the end of a few laps of her sort of leading me around, I was in thermal cutback for that was hilarious.
She's just warming up. That's the scary part. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, she's like, well, I'm just warming up. And you're like, I've cooked my bike, man. I got to go pull in.
Yep.
Damn. All right. Okay, a little bit of, you get the steep hill. And so that problem's been corrected, so no one will ever have a steep hill issue ever again from the sounds of it.
Correct.
And then, okay, so you took it home and you commuted for a while. Was there, now you've ridden, let's see, you said an 82 Kawasaki, like a, what is it, a GP's, GPZ?
Suzuki, it was a, GS650, yeah.
Oh, an old GS650, okay. And then, you went and got a used Multistrada?
Yeah, the 620, it's a, like 06 or something like that.
Oh, a little 620.
Yep, and that was an excellent second bike to have. In fact, I still have it, and it's Ducati. It's been hilarious to own that bike and the Brembo at the same time because something breaks on the Ducati, and it's $400 and 4 weeks to get the parts. And something, breaks on the Brembo, and it's $10 and 3 days.
First year production, Brembo's always right. Putting Ducati's ass in the maintenance department.
Yeah, no, it is just hilarious. Like, I've done some really stupid things to that bike. I scraped the shifter peg off on the track.
You're the one that did that.
Oh, yeah. I have busted my fair share of parts on that bike, and every time it's like a couple days. And I feel bad for the poor service writer at Scuderia because I always ask about, part XYZ and, owning a weird motorcycle like the Brembo, and let's be honest, it's a weird motorcycle.
Yeah.
You expect, sort of weirdness to be proportional to how much parts cost, right?
Yeah.
But then, like, the parts person behind the counter is like, oh yeah, that's, $22. And I just start laughing uproariously. Like,
it's funny though. It's funny. But it's, that's one of those things where people need to look at, they need to know about if they're going to.
Oh yeah.
And one of these things, it's,
going into purchasing the Impulse, I liked conceptually that it was made in the U.S. Like, rah, rah, America, et cetera. But I didn't really consider the practical and sort of, the application of that. I've never before, owned a mode of transportation where the parts are made in the next state. They, are machining the stuff there or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, and you can meet the guy who designed the part.
Yeah.
It's just insane. And so, the fact that I can get a shifter peg for, $20 or whatever hilarious nominal amount, and it's coming from Oregon. I mean, it's just, it's awesome. And, yes, I like the sort of ethereal concept of Made in America, but I like the practical application of Made in Oregon even more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something people need to think about. I mean, it's always a bit of I can kind of relate to it back in the mountain biking days in the early or in the mid to late 90s. ProFlex was a New England company. And there were very few East Coast mountain bike companies at the time. They're all West Coast fire road cruising princesses, as I like to refer to them as. And if you ever have ridden East Coast single track, you understand why I say that, even though it's, it's not so true of the West Coast people anymore. But if you had a Specialized that was a Californian company and you broke your frame, you were waiting a week or two. But if you had a ProFlex, which was out of Connecticut, and I was in Maine, and you broke your frame, the new frame arrived in 3 days.
Yeah.
I can understand that. And that's something, people really need to consider. And I wonder if they would experience a similar thing with the new, and I'm not trying to plug any other company here, but the Eric Buell
EPR
bikes.
I'm sure.
I don't think they would only charge $20 for a shifter and RS.
Yeah.
Yeah. maybe once the other ones come out, the RX the RX only looks good in black. I didn't like it in yellow or red, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. Okay, so parts are cheap. We got there somehow. Too easily distracted. you get a home commuting. What was it? Did it break in? Was there anything that you noticed, like, this needs to break in, like the suspension or the battery range improved or?
The clutch definitely got better. It was very, maybe it was after the first oil change because it has like a, 600 mile break-in period?
Yes, transmission.
Yeah, I'm honestly not even sure what's breaking in, but it definitely felt better, after some amount of time. It felt very, very industrial. The whole thing, the experience of riding an Impulse is, shifting an Impulse is very similar to like an AK-47 Bolt. it's very, industrial and mechanical, and there's some solid, force feedback you get, but it was more so, when brand new, and I was very pleased at how it broke in.
Okay. All right. And then, I know I was comparing, we were talking about your old bike. We're talking about the current one, the Ducati Multistrada.
All right.
Horsepower-wise, those are similar bikes, horsepower-wise.
Yeah, and actually, they're similar in weight, too, fascinating. Because, they're both similar in weight. The Multistrada, and I say this with love. The Multistrada I loved. It was sort of, my gateway into, much, broader types of motorcycling. I took it on a lot of trips, all of which it broke in the middle of, but, I love that bike, but when you compare getting on the Impulse to that thing, the Multistrada feels like a pig. It doesn't accelerate as quick. It doesn't have the throttle response. The weight is all up top as opposed to kind of in the middle and down low on the Impulse. It's night and day. And if you were to not look at any stat sheet and you were to ride the Impulse and that Multistrada back to back, you would guess that the Multistrada was, a third more the weight and a third less the horsepower. Like it just, or more.
Oh, wow. Huh. All right, cool. That's what I was looking to compare. Is any other comparisons? Talking about the little stuff. Is the transmission nicer on the Multistrada?
It's definitely smoother. I mean, that Multistrada has that hydraulic clutch that you can operate with like one pinky. The Multistrada transmission is very, very smooth and not at all like an AK-47. that being said, the AK-47 you can bury in mud, and the Impulse has never left me stranded due to a transmission just eating itself.
Right.
So, in fact, the reason the Multistrada is currently lying dormant is because it decided to perform impromptu origami with its own shift fork.
All right. Fair enough. go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The only thing I like better about the Multistrada is the seat. The Multistrada seat is the best thing I've ever sat on.
Okay.
The Impulse is comfortable, but you don't really have an issue with seat comfort when you're only going, 100 miles at a time. So.
Yeah. I'm wondering if the TTX, the seat that the racers developed, might not be an option.
Well, the TTX seat, I did not appreciate until I sat on one of the TTXs. And the main difference for me with the TTX seat is that, insert photo of side of Impulse here. Yeah. There are those, like, tank, in quotes, tank cutouts, with the stock R seat, your knees are a few inches below those. And with the TTX seat, because the TTX seat's, you know, taller, your knees go right into the cutouts.
Hmm.
And so because the stock impulse seat is just much lower, I mean, it is, I personally love the stock impulse seat. To me, it's very comfortable, and I like the seating position. But for the track, you know, if I were to be using that as a dedicated track bike, I would absolutely spring for a TTX seat.
How tall are you, and what's your inseam?
I'm 5'9", and I guess 30.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, because Gavin's tall like I am. I'm 6'2". I think Gavin's about my height, maybe even taller. And he'd like the TTX seat because we just got longer legs.
Yeah, yeah.
You have some more room. All right. So that's good information. That way people know. All right. All right. So then, okay, so ergonomics, switch gear, all that. I mean, that's all.
You know, when I crashed the bike, I bent the handlebars fairly fierce, and I bought an aftermarket, totally sweet Renthal Road Ultra Low, blah blah blah. You know, it had all the awesome Renthal graphics on it, and I was all prepared to be like, "Yeah, man, look at my sweet aftermarket handlebar," and I actually disliked it compared to the stock handlebar. And I actually tried finding, I searched, you know, scoured the internet for a bar that was, you know, had similar dimensions to what I measured the impulse handlebar to be. And I just, I mean, it's very flat. It's like a drag bar almost. And I don't know where they got it or whatever, but I actually ended up just totally ditching the Renthal, and I ordered another, stock OEM handlebar for like 50 cents or whatever they charge. You know?
They're going, the spare parts people right now are going, we need to charge more.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I was mad at how much they charge. They should charge less money for their parts. Yeah.
And especially compared to Ducati.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's funny that the transmissions act so differently, and like, the transmission is basically, I mean, it's Italian. It's SRME.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is transmission. That's funny. It's been complained a lot that it's clunky.
You know, I mean, isn't it like developed for dirt bikes or supermotos or something like that? I mean,
SRME, their first transmission electric motorcycle was a dirt bike, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is probably me just, you know, being used to it now, but it's just, it's different like any other motorcycle transmission is different. I rode around a friend's ZX6E for a while, and to me, that transmission actually felt more industrial than the impulses.
Okay.
And, you know, not, I use that term in like the sort of, you know, it requires slightly more authoritarian shifting. You gotta be sort of forceful with your inputs, but it's sort of, you know, the flip side of that is, you know, when you have something as easy as the Multistrada is to shift, you sort of get lazy, and, you know, you sort of just end up like sort of waggling your foot in the direction of the thing, and it shifts for you, and then it's, you know, I don't know. I actually prefer the more, you know,
positive engagement.
Exactly. That's the polite term. Yes.
Positive engagement. All right. That's how I like my bicycle shifting is positive. I don't like mushy, vague,
yeah,
plastic feeling. But yeah. Let's see here. Yeah, I probably would appreciate the impulse. The transmission. My first bike was an A6 500 Interceptor, which I am now. I've got a new one that I'm getting on the road. And my second bike was a 91 VFR, and the old 86, there was some soft things about it. And if I got happy in a twisty section of road, I kind of had to make sure I kept myself in check and wasn't too aggressive with the shifting.
Right, right, right.
You know, whereas the VFR, I could be a little more, you know, I could abuse it a little more, be a little more forceful. But I've always kind of half pictured like the someday when I get to try an impulse on the track, just like beating on the poor transmission and just kind of going.
Yeah, no, it's great. It has handled everything I've thrown it, and you know, I'm sure that I am not the best shifter. I mean, I've only been riding for a couple of years. I'm sure I'm, you know, from a technique standpoint, not all that great, and it has taken everything I've thrown at it without complaint. So
that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So we're trading maybe Honda smoothness for just outright reliability.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure when you're throwing that much torque at a thing, I'm sure that's why they had to build it like they did.
You know, that you have a point there, because as Ted Dillard pointed out in one of his blog posts, and I have to agree, I don't know if anyone's made a constant a variable speed transmission, you know, constant speed transmission. Am I making sense?
The two cones that move.
Yeah, closer, yeah, yeah. You know,
CVT.
CVT. There we go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We had a constant speed drive on the generators for military aircraft. That's what I called it. CVT. I don't think anyone's made one that can hold up to electric motor's torque. Mm. So what you just said there, knowing that little bit of information, if assuming that it's right, makes quite a bit of sense. My ear's ringing. Probably somebody's talking about me. I haven't checked the forums. Let's see if there's any angry. Take a moment to see if there's any angry people on the forums right now.
All right. I really hope you appreciated that conversation with Jeff. I did end it right there. And, the next episode, I will pick right back up right at that same exact spot. Which may leave you rather confused for a minute, but that could be kind of fun. So, in a weird, goofy kind of way. Definitely going to want to listen to next week's show, or not next week's, but the next episode, whenever I get it done and edited and scheduled to go up. There's been some things. I'm going to go do a quick news thing. Other than it is now a pay site. I have changed it from three on the written content, by the way, I've changed it from 3 free views a week to 3 free views a month. Just because no one has subscribed yet. I guess I'm being, I don't know, what is a materialistic? I am judging your support by your wallet. So instead of your really kind words. Oh, well. We all can't be as idealistic as we'd like to be. But aside from that, there's some news out there. Shalina Moreta is now the proud owner of an Inertia. I don't know if you saw that on Facebook. Arma is now going to host an electric motorcycle race series next year. It's going to be like 10 races at tracks people want to go to. This is exactly the kind of thing that the TTX GP was trying to promote. I do not know if Arma is going to be using the TTX GP's e-road racing rules package that they were developing for free. I don't know if that's the case. I do know that Jeremiah Johnson, who has been wrongly vocal on a few things for a minute or two on the forums, is behind it, is put his weight behind it, and is trying to promote it on Facebook. Arthur, I'm not going to pronounce his last name because I'm going to butcher it. The gentleman who raced the other Brembo TTX in the series this year, I think is more of a driving force behind it. He's promoted it on Facebook. I have not received any kind of press release from Arma. No one has contacted me about it. They've just posted it to Facebook, which is annoying. If you're going to promote something, will someone please put out a press release and send it to all major, you know, God. Well, that was interesting. Anyway, continued signs of disorganization is not helpful. I should have seen a press release. Someone should have been contacting me. Or I'm irrelevant. Which is fine. If I'm irrelevant and I'm not, you know, someone of meager importance in this industry, then that's fine. And that's my own thing that I got to worry about and just accept. But don't come to me and say, oh yeah, you know, get hold of me. This is getting old. And one of my serious frustrations, maybe it's my fault for not having a cell phone and so people can text me. I don't know. I've got Facebook, I've got Twitter, I've got an email address. I've got a couple email addresses. The world final was canceled. No duh. Everyone knew that was probably going to happen. About a month ago, the TTXGP said, hey, we want to, you know, talk to you and do a little interview or just talk to you. And I gave them the times that I was available and I never heard from them again. This podcast was originally supposed to be a roundtable of what looked potentially of almost 5 Impulse owners. There's way more Impulse owners out there than that. One showed up. You know, out of the 3 that promised they'd show up, and 4, there's a 4th one that looked like he was definitely going to show up, and 2 maybes, one dude showed up. If you're an owner, and you're a fan, and maybe it's just like, oh, well, you know, I'm just a fan, I'm just an owner, I'm not that important. What you need to realize is you are actually very important. You support me. This, while Jeff did an outstanding job, this could have been way more informational and better with a group of owners with varying opinions and varying experiences. When I ask for help from you folks, I mean I need your help. Like, if you want to support the sport or you want to support electric motorcycling in general or support Brammo, when I say I need you, you know, I'm doing a thing and you say you can show up, I need you to actually show up. I'm going to do this for 0 owners and we're going to see how that goes. It's going to look really bad if they all show up for the round table. It's going to look really bad, to be honest with you. This is how you support stuff, is like, don't underestimate your importance. You all are pioneers, of a fashion, of a sort. You own electric motorcycles that are brand new. And I know you're all busy, but, you know, the folks that said maybe, you know, they said maybe. So, I need help. So, I need help from people sending me press releases and stuff. And I understand, I haven't been putting out much lately. So you send me a press release and, you know, you never know if it's actually going to go anywhere or not. Although I think there's very few press releases that I get that I don't actually do something with. So I will try to dig into this ARMA thing and see what the story is behind that. But it's looking set and solid and good to go already. And then let's see what else. Oh, yes. I read Dominic's post on Autoblog Green about the Suzuki's monkey bike, which he actually got from, well, he saw the article on Asphalt and Rubber. Jensen did an article on it, and he went and did his own research to try to add to it. It was a cute little kind of just, I don't know, what a monkey bike, pit bike kind of thing. Yamaha has come out at the Tokyo show. Now, I'm going to add this, actually. I'm going to pause right there. Last year, or the year before, right before ICMA, and it was supposed to be a bunch of electric motorcycle announcements, Honda put out that RCE prototype with the squirrel motor in it. And I think that was convenient to take away any excitement and buzz generated by ICMA for the Tokyo show. And when it was finally released, it was like 2 seconds. So, oh, yeah, here's our RCE prototype, blah, 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 blah. Okay, and here's the cars, you know. So it was almost, to me, Suzuki's little thing was simply the same thing. A ploy by one of the Japanese manufacturers to help their friends at the Tokyo Motor Show take some of the buzz out of ICMA. Is how it looks to me. It doesn't look like anything other than that. Yamaha, however, at the Tokyo show, didn't announce it beforehand, so they don't look like schmucks. Apparently have got electric bikes, scooters, and motorcycles. All prototypes. The electric motorcycle actually runs. Asphalt Rubber ran a post about it. And it runs on the track. And it looks like a little 50cc motorcycle. And the camera is really low, and the turns look really tight, and you can make a little 50cc bike look like it's going pretty fast. If it has a small rider on it, the camera's really low to the ground, and the bike's going around really tight turns, so it has a good lean angle. I'm not impressed. I'm not scared. Brammo and Zero probably are not shaking in their boots at all, if that's all Yamaha's got. If that's their big electric motorcycle prototype. The equivalent of a 50cc motorcycle. I think 125 tires, race tires, are wider than that, those tires on that. I think it looks like maybe it's more like a 125, old two-stroke 125 race bike, which would now be a 250, single four-stroke. But I don't think so. I think it looks like a 50cc bike to me. Had a max speed of 100 kph. Woo, that's 62 miles an hour. Wow, now you've got the performance numbers from the 2009 Zero and Brammo Inertia. Congratulations. Actually, the Zero was faster. Doesn't look like it has a lot of battery on board, but if it's light, probably got pretty good range. But as we've seen, light goes a long way, but it does not go far enough. You've got to have a big battery pack, and you've got to have at least a halfway decent motor. And I don't think this thing is much further than where Brammo and Zero were in 2009. And if that's the case, that's really sad. Now, this thing looks a hell of a lot sexier than either one of those bikes. And it looks like it's much better built. And has, you know, cool LED headlights and little phone interface, you know, touchscreen interface and things like that, which are cool and really nice touches and stuff that you would expect that at least Yamaha would put on something like that. And it's really cool that it actually runs, and Yamaha has it running and has the balls to put it up on the internet. So hats off to Yamaha, but I'm not impressed, and I'm not scared. Jensen thought it was really cool, obviously, over at Asphalt and Rubber. I think it's cute, and I think it will be completely overblown, just like the Honda's RCE. People drooled and commented and oohed nod over that bike, and it was just a badass chassis with some pretty friggin' bling they bolted on. I mean, how hard is it to bolt a rear shock, a really nice Ohlins rear shock or something, or whatever, a high-end rear shock and some pretty wheels on something and some nice forks. It's not that hard. I've done it. The chassis design was really innovative and cool. But at the heart was that silly little motor that comes in their hybrid car, which is like a 10-kilowatt motor. I mean, it puts out tons of torque. Don't get me wrong, but it's still a 10-kilowatt motor. Horsepower is horsepower, folks. You know, so, yeah. I will continue to try to get interviews at my own pace and try to bring you guys some content worth reading and listening to. I think as far as written content, I'm going to try to delve back. I know there's a lot of stuff going on in this ARMA stuff. Maybe I'll get some cojones, and maybe I'll actually try to get a hold of Yamaha and get a hold of someone that can talk about the prototype project. That would be awesome. doubt I'll pull it off. But I guess it's worth a shot. Shit, what the hell? Yeah. So that's it for news. I'm running at about an hour and 20 minutes, so that's a little bit longer than I wanted to, but at least I put the news at the end so you don't have to listen to it if you don't want to. Thank you for listening. Thank you for paying and supporting me and supporting the sport in return. Keep the rubber side down, folks. Catch you later.